Welcome to the Macro View, episode 22. You're listening to the number one daily podcast focused on spreading the logic of liberty. I'm your host, Andrew Smith.
All right, so we have Kyle here. Give us a hello, Kyle. Yeah, all right, so now we got it all worked out. That was weird. As soon as it started, basically, we weren't able to hear you. Okay, so the debate's going to last 60 minutes. We kind of agreed to the following rules, just 5 minutes each, and we're going to try to keep time of ourselves, and we'll let each other know when it's been 5 minutes and to close up the statement at that point. So, Kyle, do you want to start with opening statement?
Yeah, I'd love to. Thank you. All right, I just want to say thank you very much for having me on. This is a very important debate for the libertarian movement. You know, these are two different philosophies. They're different paths. They have different strategies to achieve them, and they're different messages that we're trying to spread to people. So we're working at cross purposes here as far as a movement, and we're spreading mixed messages. So I'm going to start with a Mises quote. Mises is my main intellectual influence. You know, I was a former Rothbardian, but once I realized that Mises disagreed with Rothbard, I switched over to Mises. So this is a quote from Mises's book, Liberalism. And when he says liberalism, he's speaking of classical liberalism, not modern liberalism. And it was a philosophy of limited government. So here's the quote. He says, liberalism is not anarchism, nor has it anything whatsoever to do with anarchism. The liberal understands quite clearly that without resort to compulsion, the existence of society would be endangered, and that behind the rules of conduct, whose observance is necessary to assure peaceful human cooperation, must stand the threat of force if the whole edifice of society is not to be continually at the mercy of any one of its members. One must be in a position to compel the person who will not respect the lives, health, personal freedom, or private property of others to acquiesce in the rules of life in society. This is the function that the liberal doctrine assigns to the state, the protection of property, liberty, and peace. And that quote is from Liberalism. So, you know, in contrast to Murray Rothbard, who is an enemy of the state, Mises puts the state at the center of his philosophy. It's the cornerstone of his philosophy. It basically holds it all together by enforcing the rules of capitalism. In another quote he has, which I'm not going to read, he says that the market requires the state as its enforcement mechanism. So that's about my introductory statement. I've been antagonistic towards anarchist, anarcho-capitalist for quite some time now. And I've kind of developed a reputation on Facebook as being an antagonizer. But I think it's important that we get on the right page, which in my opinion is minarchism, limited government, and not anarchism.
Thanks so much for that, Kyle. I appreciate your opening statement. So in my argument for no state, I will be making the following points. I'll make the point that a minimal state is, and this is my first point, the minimal state is a fantasy world and does not exist in a sustainable fashion, that all organisms grow. That includes collective social organisms, which is what a state is, and that a minimal state before long becomes a large state. A minimal state still maintains the arbitrary claim to legitimized violation of positive rights, that is, rights that are extra legal and come from one's humanity. And even in the small, even in the days of the smallest minarchy utopia in the U.S. in the late 1800s, individual rights were violated over and over and over again. And the answer every time the state violated individual rights in mass, whether it was local government, state government, or federal government, the answer was always for more government and always has been. The reason for this is specifically their claim to legitimacy that territorial sovereigns have over their subjects or their citizens. when governments do things that no one else will get away with doing, even if we don't agree with it, many people just kind of shrug their shoulders. So take asset forfeiture for example. Most people would be appalled by the idea of some hacker hacking in and taking money out of somebody's bank account without their permission. But yeah, that's what the IRS and law enforcement agencies do. And law enforcement agencies, it's gotten even worse in some places where they'll just swipe somebody's debit card or credit card when they pull them over. This is true with eminent domain as well, which is another form of asset forfeiture. No one would ever let a private corporation without the help of government force a private homeowner to sell their house to them at a value that they deemed market value arbitrarily in order to turn around and build anything, let alone private property use like has been done recently and was upheld with Kelo. And that happens here and around the world. There's nowhere else where things like this, these really bad arbitrary violations of positive rights, don't happen. So the second argument I'm going to make is that the essential functions of government are extremely marketable. And he brought up the idea of markets, and markets need government without them. But that's absolutely not true. In fact, the Amsterdam stock market is a great example of extra legal financial markets in which literally contracts were not even enforceable by law because interest was illegal. And that interest was illegal in many countries back in the days of the Middle Ages. Contracts weren't enforceable by law, but yet there still was a robust market for financial contracts. The third point that I'm going to make is that utopia does not exist. And the idea is you know, you've got to take that into the assumption that anarcho-capitalism isn't aiming for a utopia. What it's saying is that this would just be better because there'd be a lot more accountability amongst governing bodies if they were not territorial sovereigns and if they're 100% voluntary and opted into. The fourth point that I'm going to make is that warring is largely out of fashion and that pillage is known to be unprofitable. The state is the primary reason for war. They propagandized war throughout history, have either provided manipulative incentives for military and war personnel or have actually conscripted their subjects to military service. In order to get people to be willing to go to war, you either have to give them incentives that the market can't readily provide, like a status as a hero in the past they gave them plots of land like in the British Empire, or they can give them positions in governments, in non-democratic societies and authoritative societies. And the U.S., we've had both conscripted military service and what I call hero incentives, and this combination goes back as far as nation states still. In a stateless society, it's not a society without rules, and this is the fifth point that I'm going to make. It's simply a society in which the stakeholders and the owners voluntarily opt into a set of rules, much the way the Amish have rules, but allow at a certain age of adulthood, they allow their children to go out into a community and go outside the community and go and see the world for themselves and come back and decide, do I want to live that way or do I want to live this way? And it's 100% voluntary, and they don't look upon their children with ill will if they decide to leave the community. Now, obviously, I'm not advocating that we become Amish and give up technological advances, but what I'm saying is that having a system where upon adulthood, people can choose whether or not they want to live under that system of rules or be able to opt into a different system of rules and go and have their own private property rights, that would be a much better system given the frameworks that we've had laid out by past intellectuals and some things that we can, you know, just think about the way that they work in the market today. I think that it is a system that, you know, though Kyle would think that it's most likely, if not 100% likely to fail, I think that it's very likely to work so long as you have a people that understand that productivity is more profitable and more enjoyable and gives more utility than does pillage and warring. So with that, Kyle, thank you. And since this is my podcast, I'm going to pose the first question to you, and you can use the next 5 minutes to either rebut my opening statement or to answer the question or both or make your own statement, whatever you want to do with it. So in your mind, what are the essential functions of a state?
Okay, you know, the primary purpose of a state is protection of life and property from violent and fraudulent attacks. So it would, you know, enforce laws. It would protect people. It would judge disputes, adjudicate disputes, arrest criminals, lock them up. So typically the functions are listed as the police power, courts, prisons, and armed forces, which are all compulsive or compulsory apparatuses. It's an agency of force. Now, we debate endlessly online over the administration of public property, which would be roads. Does the state do roads or not? I don't have a decisive answer to that. You know, the logistics of private roads are very confusing to me. The logistics of privatizing the sky and oceans, large bodies of water that are shared by a giant community, I don't see how those could be privatized. But, you know, that's not really the position that I'm here to fight for. I'm here to fight for the law and order, national defense, court system. That to me would be the minarchist state that I'm defending here. It's, you know, it's a governing body is what it is. So, you know, I took notes during your opening statement. I guess I have a little bit of time left. I did want to talk about, the claim to legitimacy, which was your first point. A lot of people don't understand where government gets its legitimacy from. It gets its legitimacy. They'll say, oh, it's just basically a gang. It's like the mafia, and it just basically took over against the people's will. It's the opposite of that. It's the will of the people, or the will of the majority in particular, that gives the state its power. So when it has public support, when it has majority support, that's why it's so powerful, because the people are behind it. It's a communal organization. So, you know, to say that it's not legitimate, you're actually denying the will of the people, or the will of the majority of the people that live in that area that desire that governing body.
So who holds, and this would be my response to you, is who holds that governing body accountable? Because it seems to me that historically you've never really had any actual accountability. And I would point out the fact that there's been millions of CEOs, CFOs, chief marketing officers, heads of companies all over the world. Maybe millions is an exaggeration, but certainly hundreds of thousands over the years, if you're talking about public and private companies, firing of managers, and it happens all the time. And yet there's been in U.S. history, which I guess you would argue for going back to sort of more of an originalistic view of the, you know, of the Constitution and having a separation of powers, who holds that accountable? Because in federal government, there's never been a president who was impeached and convicted. So, I mean, you've had a couple of presidents be impeached. You've had Nixon resign, but then be pardoned. So who actually holds criminals in, you know, because there's definitely, I know politicians like to say CEOs, you know, you're too big to jail and all of that rhetoric, but that's a bunch of bullshit. I mean, especially in the financial industry, people go to jail all the time for breaking rules. But it seems to me that except for in really egregious and obvious cases at local levels, people in government just happen to be above the law, and in some cases actually place themselves above the law, even in a country that has a constitutional framework like the U.S. And therefore, I would posit that having more of a corporate governance structure and having cooperative ownership and having actual real positive incentives for good management and to create abundance as opposed to drag out a problem and spend as much money as possible on it, which is what the bureaucratic state does. That's how they grow. That's how they get bigger budgets. I would posit that having a corporate cooperative structure would just be far more effective for the delivery of those essential functions that you deem necessary.
Yeah, let me respond to that. On a small level, if you have an individual, say a crooked mayor or something like that, there are internal checks within the government to deal with that. You have, for the police, you have internal affairs departments. At higher levels, you have courts, you know, court systems that judge when politicians have done wrong. So there are some internal checks. But on a macro level, as far as the overall direction of the government, it's up to the people of that country to check their own government. They're the ultimate check. And it always does actually reflect the will of the majority. I mean, it certainly doesn't reflect the will of libertarians, but our government is almost a perfect mirror of the composition of our population, which is, you know, at least the politically active component, which is half Republican, half Democrat. You know, we have a lot of people that like these foreign wars. We've got a lot of people that want a wall built. We have a lot of people that support Obamacare. You know, these are very popular programs. Obama was very popular with the left. Trump was very popular with the right. So it ultimately, even a totalitarian dictatorship like Nazi Germany, there was public support. I mean, Hitler in his heyday was extremely popular with the Germans. And, you know, that popularity enabled him to do all the things that he was able to do. You really can't govern as an unpopular ruler. The people just won't go along. And a great example of that was in Egypt recently when the people took to the streets because they didn't like Hosni Mubarak. And, you know, he was forced to step down because the people just would not accept him as their president any longer.
Okay, so like, first off, I would respond by saying Hitler did govern and took over most of Europe until he was murdered, basically, or was on the verge of being murdered and committed suicide, as the story goes. So I don't think that that's a valid argument. I think that your argument just points out the flaws in the idea of the will of the majority and how the will of the majority can lead to some of the most egregious positive rights violations. And I'm not talking about rights there's some things that you look, I don't agree with Murray Rothbard that a parent's allowed to let their kids starve. So I'll say that that's not a right. You don't have the right to let something that you own be neglected, because that, in my opinion, even though that would probably go against most anarcho-capitalists, in my opinion, I think that there is a certain level of responsibility to take care of things that you own. And if you don't, then there should be, and I do think in an anarcho-capitalist society, there would be a way to deal with that within a smaller community and through things like exile and forced and shaming. And I think that things like that are very valuable tools. And I'll go back to the example of holding people accountable for even minor, not just rights violations, but for going against, popular opinion, or for even, I want to say, being politically incorrect, but I don't like the fact that's the word that I have to use, essentially for saying things that are offensive to a small group of people. You've had a number of corporate executives over the past number of years, over the past decade, at least since I've been following the market, a number of big case scenarios where CEOs have been ousted for something that they said, not even something that they did, but something that they said. And that goes back to what Adam Smith talked about as the theory of moral sentiments, and how public opinion in a private sphere with an invisible hand actually gets a lot more done for issues that people care about, and it moves the ball forward far faster than bureaucracy and government can. And my main argument is not that it would be perfect. My main argument is that it would be far more efficient than the system that we have, where we wait a couple of years and go and vote, and wait another couple of years and go and vote. It'd be much easier to opt out and to secede and to move around, to change the rules locally, and be able to try to pursue, you know, what the founders deemed as a more perfect union, and what I believe to be what needs to be a voluntary union, because of the interdependence of trade and the division of labor. That's what gives us the desire to not war against each other. It's not state, it's not laws, it's not rules. It's the desire to have a better life and to be more productive, and to leave the next generation off, our children, to leave them off better than we came in. And I think that that is a very powerful and strong desire, and that even absent of a state apparatus, not saying that, you know, it's tomorrow, but let's say that tomorrow we woke up and just everybody that worked for the government decided they were going to quit and go get a piece of land and start farming. I think generally people will come together and start handling those services. And there's back to the point that the services are extremely marketable. I mean, these services are extremely, extremely marketable and profitable if handled properly. The problem is that government management is extremely inefficient. It has perverse incentives. So, you know, you, like you said, court, law, rule enforcement, basic infrastructure, national defense. If let's say it was a just for the thought experiment, a pure democracy, and you got four issues that you got to fund. You had four issues that you got to fund, and you rank order voted. And you had a slate of 50 issues, but four of them actually got funded. Courts, law, rule enforcement, courts, law, and rule enforcement, basic infrastructure, and national defense, those would be one through four on 99% of people's lists. So to say that they're not marketable, well, if you just took government and put the word corporation in front of it, or if you just took you don't even need some of those structures, if you just understood that there are entrepreneurs who would be more than happy to find profitable solutions to some of these issues and do it in a way that's way more fair than the existing system. That one of my arguments is that the existing system has a lot of flaws because it's impossible to hold the people that are in charge accountable because of the inefficiency of a system of democratic voting. And the everyday dollar vote is a much more efficient system of holding people accountable.
Well, there's a lot to respond to there. I'll just try to take it one at a time or one thing. When we talk about democracy, usually the comparison is democracy versus autocracy, like either a monarchy or a dictator, and where the people really don't have a chance, any kind of option to peacefully change the regime. So the benefit of democracy compared to that system is that if we have a really bad guy, the people can vote and we can adjust the administration to the will of the people through voting, to the will of the majority, I should say. You're actually arguing for another alternative, which is almost private governance, I guess, or voluntary governance. I have a problem with that term, voluntary governance, because it's really – governing really isn't voluntary. When you are going to make a rule and somebody breaks that rule, the punishment is not voluntary to them. Or if you have a private protection agency, it's voluntary when you pay them, but when they go and crack down or use force against someone else, it's not voluntary to that person. So like all these ANCAPs who say they're voluntarists have fully in mind that they're going to employ private coercion to enforce private property rights or to protect life and property and enforce their rules. So I really take exception to the notion that governance is voluntary. It might be voluntary to you as the purchaser, but it's not voluntary to the person being governed.
Yep. And I would make the argument that in excessive use of force against criminals, that would go way down in a privatized governance system, and simply for the fact that juries would not look upon people who shot young black teenagers in the back as they're running away as possibly okay, and possibly allowed to do that, like we just saw happen in North Carolina and like we've seen happen many, many times, and not just with black people, with white people, with Hispanic people. I read a story a number of years ago where a lady in Florida fit the description of a van that they thought had drugs in it. She's an 80-year-old lady, and they ripped her out of the car. That would never occur in a system where one incident would ruin that company, where they become uninsurable again. They become uninsurable, where one incident would make nobody else want to pay into that private corporation, and they go with people that have better systems of punishment and better systems of moving people that were nuisances to a community out of the community. There's ways to do it. There's technology that can do it. You can make it a very uncomfortable living space for them without having any physical harm done to them. And look, I'm just saying that it wouldn't be as bad as what you see now. I mean, what would it have to look like? I'd put the question to you is what would it have to actually look like for you to say that police don't do a good job currently And then on the national defense side, I think from an economic calculation standpoint, it would make no sense to go and wage aggression overseas. What you would actually have is you have an apparatus of defense. It'd most likely be paid for by property insurance companies, large cross-border, cross-state property insurance companies that had a reason to invest in strong national defense and would also be able to put out bounties in the case of imminent attack, which would allow for a number of different operators, private operators, to be able to take to arms to be able to defend against them and their neighbors' land for the sake of freedom from foreign tyranny. So I just don't see it. You wouldn't have, you know, bombs being dropped out of airplanes in this world, right? You'd have really incredible missile defense systems and the type of stuff that Reagan talked about with Star Wars. That would probably be more realistic under this type of scenario, because you'd have a positive purpose to invest in that type of long-term, long-horizon technology, because the ability to lower premiums then, and at the which means that you'd be able to have a much larger base of customers. If you had that, you'd be able to then, you know, make a lot more money if you had a larger base of customers, lower premiums, and less chance of there being an insurance claim coming against you. So from a standpoint of the way that money is used within that apparatus, I would once again argue, like, what would it have to look like for them to be doing a bad job? And don't you think that where people try to save face and where people try to save money, that you would have a lot less bomb dropping and a lot less shooting of teenagers in a private corporate governance situation? And yeah, we have to have laws, right? Neither of us. But what I'm saying is, how are those laws enforced today versus in the event that you had a competitive situation where different private law enforcement groups could shame another law enforcement group for letting something egregious happen under one of their employment's watch? I happen to believe that it's impossible to hold the state accountable. And I see all the time corporations being held accountable and above and beyond accountable. So I just don't see that as a valid argument, because you're right. Yeah, there's these essential functions, but they fail at doing it in a way that doesn't violate individual rights. They are horrible at it, basically. They're not very good at it. So I just ask you, like, what would it have to look like for you to say, okay, yeah, I agree, they're not very good at it?
Well, I think that a lot of ANCAPs tend to focus on the negative. You know, they focus on the drug war. They focus on police brutality. They don't typically look at the instances where, you know, the serial killer or the guy that shot up the church was arrested and put in jail where he belongs. There's plenty of instances where people do get justice through the court system, where they have their dispute, resolved through the court system. And, you know, they need that authority over both parties in order to resolve that dispute, and so that dispute doesn't continually keep escalating into an arms race between two conflicting private interests.
And well, at a certain point.
Never
mind.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, at a certain point, it no longer becomes worth fighting the legal battle, right? That's why you have a certain number. I mean, even in today's system, you say a race to arms. I mean, that's what you have with the public defender, and you don't get a public defender. You have, you know, ACLU come in and appeal the case and go to an appeal court. I mean, you still have that, and you still eventually have multiple levels of confirmation of a professional legal opinion, and sometimes it's wrong. It's a lot. I happen to believe that it would be wrong a lot less under this system. And I also happen to believe in what the founders of this country believed in. I think one of the things that's most egregious about one of the things that we don't follow in this country, is one of the most egregious things, is the idea that, you know, I would rather let 999 people that are guilty walk free than to let one innocent man be put in prison. And I think that you'd have a lot fewer innocent people being put in prison under a system where you had a private legal opinion and you had secondary legal opinions who would be able to say, wait, let's take a look at this case. You missed this or you missed that. I'm willing to take a second look at this case. I think you'd have a lot less people that are being punished for something that they did do, that they didn't do. And to me, when the state punishes somebody for something that they didn't do, that's far worse. That's far worse than when somebody commits a crime and through technicality, because the state acted improperly, or in my situation, because the private governance organization acted improperly in the investigation and the arrest or whatever, I am much more comfortable with those people being let free than I am with innocent people being held in a cage. And I think you get a lot less of that under private legal.
Well, I do want to get to the meat of the argument against anarchy, which is that, in my opinion, we have a completely different conception of what anarchy looks like. And to me, anarchy is faction wars. Anarchy is large factions of people with sort of similar political views fighting for dominance in society. So, you know, there might be, 30 million people who want socialism. There might be 30 million people who want social democracy, 30 million people who want conservatism. So what you get is these large groups that simply refuse to comply to any effort at private governance. They're not afraid to use violence. They're not afraid to organize armies. It's the differences of opinion that people have over how society should be organized and what the rules should be. And that's where you get this fighting. And so to me, I just don't think that any private entity is going to be strong enough to get these people to conform to ANCAP law.
So I would answer that in a couple of ways. Again, it is not the state that creates order. What creates order is the division of labor and interrelated trade and the interdependence that trade creates. So that's, I would start off with that, that the order is not created by the state. If anything, chaos began being created when kings decided to take over land and claim it for themselves and take it from indigenous people. And the result of all of that was that I would say thousands of years behind technologically today than what we otherwise should be. So I'd say that order is created by the division of labor and interdependent relationships that result from the division of labor and trade. So I think that that's the first view, you know, difference in our views, is that where order comes from, you believe it comes from the state. I believe that it's damaged by the state. And the second point that I would make in regards to warring factions is that that's pretty much what we have now, and that's one of the biggest issues. And one of the biggest issues with a state in general is that there's no such thing as a peaceful uprising. You mentioned earlier, and I didn't get to it in one of my earlier points, but you mentioned earlier that, you know, people can vote out bad people and vote in good people. When does that really happen? Because I've been waiting for that to happen. But it seems to it seems to me that we just keep voting in worse and worse people. And occasionally you get someone who's maybe okay in the middle. But it just seems to me that if what you're saying is that the problem is that everybody believes that it's okay as long as they're the majority to violate each other's rights. See, I think that the problem is that there's a root problem, and that is the goodies that are given out. That there's violations that government is constantly pursuing. So people say, hey, if they're going to do it, why not do it for things that I'm in favor of, things that will benefit my pocketbook, or things that there is no such thing as, once you have a state, there is no such thing as equality. It becomes because they have that false claim to legitimacy, or maybe it's a legitimate claim to legitimacy. Okay. So get in your world, that even if they have a legitimate claim to legitimacy, that is specifically what I've even heard people, because of that, go on to make the argument that things like the Second Amendment are obsolete because, you know, the U.S. government would just destroy an uprising, that there's no way that people could uprise. And that just furthers my point that there's no such thing as this minimal state. But I personally don't believe that. I don't think that, at least in America, I don't think that the people in the military would take orders and turn arms on their brothers. I think that there is something culturally different about America. And I think that that also goes back, even though a lot of us forget it, it goes back to the fact that we are interrelated and interdependent on trade. But even in the example of an uprising where people disagree with certain laws, you had the war against the war between the states. So you end up in the this really weird world where you're like, okay, well, I think, you know, government is allowed to, based on the majority's view, violate rights. And I also believe that most people are good enough to not vote for really horrible rights violations, but then that's just constantly proven wrong. People vote in favor of constant, constant rights violations. And I'd say the next point is that I saw you make a point on Facebook earlier that the rich would be able to win at the expense of the poor. But that's just a Dickensian view of capitalism. And I just fundamentally disagree with that. I think that the Scrooge caricature is totally false, that the Scrooge character is actually propped up by the state. In a free society, free of competition and intellectual property rights, competition would step in on the basis of the fact that that guy's a douchebag asshole who doesn't help anybody and he's got all this money and does no charity. And I think that you already see that happening today. I mean, look at situations like Donald Sterling. Even worse, the guy, the founder of Lululemon, just said, oh, well, some women shouldn't buy my pants. And the next thing you know, he's being ousted from the company. The corporate structure and the private governance structure is much more accountable to both decency and non-violation of rights. Because, I mean, if people are upset about the fact that the guy said some women shouldn't buy my pants because they don't have the right body for it, then they're definitely going to be upset if some corporate, you know, some CEO of a private law enforcement agency starts, you know, tells his enforcers to cross borders into this other community that's ruled by a different enforcement agency and start taking them hostage or something, or start pillaging. People would be disgusted by that. Like, I just don't, maybe not in places like the Arab world, but we're talking about the developed and the Western world. And I don't see that as being very realistic. I see that as the only way that happens is when there's no competition and it's a territorial sovereign with a false claim to legitimacy to use violent force, even in the event that there is not provable guilt that's been laid out by a jury of their peers. And that happens constantly. That happens all the time. There's legal, legitimate uses of force. And in the event of what they call an imminent attack, and maybe sometimes it is imminent, maybe it isn't. I don't have CIA contacts that they're telling me, hey, yeah, that's for sure. But it seems to me that it's the state that takes up aggression and nobody has a problem with it, that if it were a competitive private organization, that would be the end of that organization if they did something like that and it later came out to be found out that it was done on a lie and that millions of people's lives were lost. I just don't see that as being able to get passed through in a private stakeholder society, whereas the false claim to legitimacy, or in your view, the legitimate claim to legitimacy the government has, it allows them to get away with it and get away with a lot worse.
Yeah, we've got to shorten up these responses a little bit, get a little more dialogue going here.
I agree. I am getting a little bit extended, and you should interrupt me because I'm sure, as you know, ANCAPs will go on forever. So, and I do, although I don't agree with all of them, I do agree with I do have some of the tendencies. So,
well, going back to majority, I want to say if ANCAPs aren't the majority in a certain area, you know, they're not going to be able to establish a private governance kind of society. I mean, you're not going to be able to pull it off if, you know, most of the population are Republicans and Democrats or socialists and nationalists. Those other factions are just going to form a new government. You know, it's really easy for them to set up a government. It takes 5 minutes. So it's just an organization. And people think like,
right,
oh, you can slay the state. You can't slay it. It's like trying to slay a committee people just create a new committee, or trying to fight terror. You can't beat terror because somebody commits another act of terror and then the war on terror is back on. Well,
right,
you beat the state, somebody just forms a new state. So you actually need to have the majority of the people in that particular country or that particular region on the same page. And that's where we're trying to get, I'm trying to get as a libertarian, a classical liberal is really what I prefer to call myself, you know, trying to pull ANCAPs into my sphere so that to make my faction larger so that we can try to take over the state and impose capitalism on social democrats and on nationalists and on socialists. You know, we want private property capitalism to be the law of the land. They want a welfare state. They want a warfare state. You know, so we're actually in a struggle for dominance against them. And it's just ANCAP's not going to work as long as they are the majority.
So I would say that obviously that is factually 100% true, and there's no argument against that. And if the argument were to, if the debate were positioned as, can this work right now, or would anybody ever vote for this right now? Obviously the answer is no. I mean, look at the people that we do vote for. So obviously that's not the case. And yes, I would actually argue that it wouldn't just have to be a majority or a super majority, that it would actually have to be, it would have to be everybody. It'd have to be unanimous, you know? So, I mean, it is a far stretch to say that practically speaking, it's a political philosophy that will come into existence within our lifetime. On both utilitarian and moral grounds, however, I personally believe that it is a framework that should be tried somewhere. And, you know, I think that there are, you know, there's talk about the Belle Isle. I don't know if you know about that in Detroit.
No.
So there's a guy that was trying to buy, basically, I'm not sure, it's in the river, and either it borders Canada or there's something unique about it where it's, I think it's like right on the border, like half of it's in Canada, half of it's in the U.S. And it's just basically a piece of land, a little strip of land. I think it's like 10, you know, or 11 square miles. So it's a pretty decent strip of land. And some guy was trying to buy it and wanted to turn it into essentially what would be a, you know, special administrative region that would have, you know, basically 100% voluntary opt-in rules, and that would be a stakeholder society. So basically the citizens and the residents owned the services and appointed management and all that, you know, kind of stuff, what we're talking about. So I think I'd love to see it exist. You know, I'd love to see small scale, you know, small scale in the sense of today's nation states, but something along the lines of a Singapore or a Macau, somewhere close to home, somewhere nearby where people can see it. I think that the extreme cases, and one of the reasons that I argue in the affirmative of no state, is that if you're able to make that argument, it becomes a lot easier. If you're able to show that these a lot of these services that are deemed the essential services are things that are highly marketable, and the things that we would say, look, these aren't essential services, and maybe half of the people think that they are and half of the people think that they aren't, well, maybe the half of the people that think that they are will put up 50% more money, you know, to provide them to themselves. Or maybe there are ways like what David Friedman talks about with broadcasting, where you have one product that has a positive consumer cost and a negative producer cost. You have another product that has a positive producer cost and a negative consumer cost. You package them together, you give it away. Situations like charitable housing could be done that way, where you have advertising or you have, you know, streaming videos on the outside of the TV and on the outside of the building on a big screen TV. There's all sorts of, I'm not the person that's going to come up with each and every, but that's the beauty about a capitalist society, which I think you would agree, is that you get a lot of different options as to how to consume goods. And I just personally, I believe that making the argument that a lot of these services that look, government versus corporation or cooperative, these are just simply different delivery mechanisms for the service, and which is going to be more efficient based on what we know and what we've seen in history.
Well, let me interject.
Yep.
When you talk about the marketability of services, you are making the assumption that your society is already organized around private ownership of the means of production and a market economy. And that is not a given. That comes about from the laws already being in place mandating that you're going to have private ownership of the means of production and a market economy. The law assigns to, you know, individual A, individual B, individual C, a section of land. It says you have exclusive control of this. No one else can mess with you, or you got to answer to us. You know, so that private property comes about or is protected by that authoritarian command. It's not, you know, because Kyle Wagner is strong enough to defend his little section of land against the horde. You know, the state has my back. So that's where I think private property actually relies on state enforcement. And you can't just take that for as a given and say, okay, now we can buy and sell law and we can buy and sell justice. It you know, you're presuming the laws are already in place.
I think it's an improper way to frame it. But really quickly, let me address. So is what you're saying that private property is not a positive right, that private property is not extra legal, that private property only exists under the context of the state?
You know, some people will say it's natural or whatever. I don't think so. I think it's basically a man-made rule. Just like pass interference is a man-made rule in football, I think when you have a group of humans and a group of land, people say, okay, we're going to divide this up into little private squares, and everybody's going to have their square. So I don't think it's a given in a social order. And if you look at past social orders like Indian tribes or whatever, feudalism, you know, people organize themselves all kinds of different ways. You know, the communists were like, hey, we don't need private ownership of the means of production. That's not the best way to organize this. So they tried a completely different model. You know, it failed miserably, of course, you know, but they changed the rules. They changed the laws, which changed their social order, changed the social structure, and they had a different order. And, you know, in that system, if you tried to withhold private property, if you tried to own a factory for profit, they would prosecute you as though that was a crime, because that was a crime under that set of laws.
Yep. And so I would say that I would disagree with you fundamentally. I'd say that private property is a natural and positive right, and that it essentially boils down to, and it gets pretty rough here, and you got to understand primitive animal, the primitive animal mentality and go back pretty far, but it basically boils down to the commitment strategy. And that exists in nature as well. The animals, in some way, shape, or form, mark their territory. It used to be far before the government was involved, and I happen to know this because I have a family member that homesteaded land in Iowa before it was a state, when it was just simply a territory. And there wasn't – you just went and put up stakes. That's literally how you claimed land. And I think I'll be able to work this amount in the amount of time that I have. So I'm going to put stakes around this amount and, you know, maybe have a little bit of extra land to have a little yard space or something, or to build, you know, to expand upon my home if I happen to become rich back in the day. And if anybody tried to test them back in, it was called the Wild Wild West for a reason, you kind of had marshals and stuff, but it was virtually lawless. And it wasn't constant like they picture, like they show it in the movies. Otherwise, nobody would come. Right? It wasn't just constant murder everywhere. What it actually was, yeah, sometimes hordes would try to come upon somebody's private property. But the desire and the commitment, and there's actually even scientific studies that say that adrenaline will do things like this, will allow people to, if they truly believe that that's their land, that they'll fight off three or four people. And what ends up happening is over time, people realize, look, that person's going to be willing to fight to the death. Even if we do overcome, we're going to be so badly wounded that it's going to be really difficult for us to enjoy the treasures of our pillage. So it is not something that's – I mean, it is an extra legal right that comes from one's own ability to essentially claim and defend something for a long enough period of time that they begin to develop a sentimental attitude towards it and are willing to defend it. And on second note, I would say that in modern times, if you're to move towards anarcho-capitalism, similar to the way that Mises discusses money and the regression theorem that money had a value because, you know, today, because it had a value yesterday, and people saw that they were able to exchange it for a certain value yesterday, and all the way down the line until you start with a bunch of different mediums of exchange. And then over time, people realize that universally people are willing to accept gold and silver and copper and some of those things. So I just think that you'd have something similar where the regression theorem kind of works the same way. If you owned it yesterday and you owned it the day before and people know you've owned it for 15 years and there's nobody around saying, no, he doesn't own that, then or the vast majority of people around you are saying, yeah, they do own that, you'd still have private property right. I will say that you are correct, though, and that there have been cultures and states that have revoked the idea of private property. And then the third thing I'll put to make this point is that land is not the only form of property, and I'm sure that you know that as well.
Yeah, I know. It's just the easy convenience to talk about land. If you're in a community that generally respects it, I suppose it could work. If you're in a community of ANCAPs and everybody sort of respects each other's property, you tend to be fine. It's when you live in a country of social democrats that want everything for free and they don't respect your financial property that, you know, it makes it really tough. You know, we act
it's
like
true.
Everybody respects private property, but we actually live in a society where people a lot of times don't respect private property. So it's tough. And you really need to be able to back it up. You know, it's not enough to just be an individual because the individual – is really no match for a group. So what ends up happening is in a conflict, people form groups for strength. You know, that you see it in prison. A guy goes into prison and he needs to join a gang so that he can survive. Gangs are always going to be more powerful than individuals. And as the larger and larger gangs trump each other, you end up with a government, you know.
But it's not – I wouldn't just say that it's larger and larger because necessarily the – you know, the Allied forces in World War II were actually a smaller force as far as troops. They were more tenacious and had better strategy and executed more properly. And then eventually we dropped a bomb on Japan that basically was, you know, devastating enough to where they were willing to say after the second one, okay, maybe we shouldn't do this anymore. Let's just stop. That's enough. So I wouldn't necessarily say that's true all the time. I do think that, you know, and obviously I agree with you that yes, in a world where most people are social democrats, it's going to be very hard to do. And that's what most people are in America. And that's one of the problems is that everybody's trying to appeal to that and nobody's preaching truth. And it's just a bunch of populism.
Yeah. I talk about group conflicts a lot. I try to emphasize that and national defense is a part of that too. I mean, you know, you could consider other countries to be large collectives. If Russia declared war on us, if North Korea declared war on us, if China declared war on us, you know, there's going to be a tendency for people to join up and provide some sort of common defense. You know,
correct.
Immediately the notion of an individual defense goes out the window and it's like, hey, we gotta raise an army here or these guys are going to wipe us out. And,
of course. And
you know, that threat is actually real. It is real sometimes. They moved the nuclear missiles into Cuba and God, that could have been terrible. So
yeah,
there is the threat of other collectives.
From Miami, my parents grew up with that. And obviously my father disagrees with me on some of the same, mainly for purposes like that. And we are coming up. We've got about another 5 minutes left in the hour. And we can go a little bit over, but I wanted to just let you know that we have that little bit of a little bit of time left. So,
okay. Well, let's see here. You said you kind of make the assumption that your society is going to be under ANCAP rules. That kind of to me goes against the concept of anarchy. If it's anarchy, I'm a sovereign individual. And I don't have to listen to anybody. That's the anarchist mindset. But you're talking about private governance, like as if people are going to submit to these corporations as governors, these for-profit corporations. And, I just don't see that happening.
Currently, no. No, I mean, it's an uphill battle to fight with people's current political ideology for sure. I have no expectations that in my lifetime something like this would actually be realistic, except for on a very small scale. And it would be something that would come into existence via opting into and voluntarily and going into understanding, look, these are sort of the rules that are here. There's private property. You're buying private property. You get a stake of, you get a stake of the companies that manage these basic services. Another point of corporate, this is corporate tradition, doesn't necessarily have to be the way that it works, but corporate tradition is a 5% stakeholder group can launch a proxy vote to change management, change board of directors, et cetera. To me, that's much more efficient. You get a chance to go and make your case. I mean, 5%, you could probably, if that were the case in America, where the libertarians could launch a proxy against the president, you'd probably have a lot more active libertarians, you know? So, and then on the opposite side of it, it could become a situation, and David Friedman talks about this a little bit, where when you're talking about two different enforcement agencies, I mean, we kind of have that now. Or examples of how it might look. If you're an American, diplomat or a diplomat from another country in different territories, you basically are under your own rules and typically, I mean, there are cases of diplomats not paying tickets and stuff like that, but you don't really have cases of diplomats going and staking out people's property or murdering people and stuff like that. For obvious reasons, because we would reject their diplomatic immunity if that occurred. As a community, I've never said that anarcho-capitalism is free of communities or groups coming together to solve problems. The difference is that the people voluntarily opt into the rule structure and have an ability to opt out of it. Now, obviously, if the other places that they can go to are not anarcho-capitalist with their rule structure, they're in a predicament and you end up having trade-offs. Again, not utopia, but a private governance structure would allow for a lot more accountability when it comes to some of the basic essential functions that government provides. And that would be my closing statement. If you want to make a quick closing statement, Kyle, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't think it's possible to let people opt out. I mean, like your basic solution there, if people want to opt out of your ANCAP society, was they have to leave because they don't want to comply with those rules. Voluntarily, like they have to leave. That's the same thing we tell, or libertarians get told, if you don't like it, move to Somalia. You know, once you get a social structure established and law and a set of laws, a set of rules for that society established, it doesn't work to just say, okay, Joe, these rules don't apply to you. You can go, rob banks or whatever because you're not subject to the law and you didn't sign the form. So people are born into pre-existing societies. And that's why we grow up, subject to the rules of those societies. We can change them as we become adults. We can get into politics and try to change the laws. But I just don't see rules as being voluntary to be practical for a social order. I guess one final thing would be marketable functions. You said that everything the state does can be marketable. I don't know what price you put on somebody's freedom. If you're going to pay to have somebody incarcerated for the rest of their life because they did something wrong, what is the market value of that? I don't know how you price that. To me, that's not an exchange thing. That's a communal decision. It's a part of the justice system. So, I hope I've given you some things to think about. I have not been converted to anarcho-capitalism. I don't know that I've converted you to minarchism, but hopefully I've given you some points to think about.
And hopefully as well here, again, probably not going to convert each other, but hopefully it was, I think you made some really great points. Not going to be able to finish up rebutting all of them. Obviously that's, the nature of a debate, but I really appreciate you coming on tonight, Kyle. It was really fun. I had a good time and I really hope that we can do this again soon and maybe leading up to, some of the midterm elections or something like that. I can have you on a couple times regularly to talk a little bit more about actual strategy and what you'd like to see out of the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian movement.
Yeah, I'd encourage you to get involved, to reengage in politics. I believe that this is a political struggle and that's the way forward, much more so than just talking about anarcho-capitalist theory. on Facebook. I think we got to win some elections. So please consider that. And thank you very much for having me on.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on. All right, everybody. I hope that you enjoyed tonight's debate between Kyle and I. I had a good time. Hopefully we'll have Kyle on again sometime in the future to talk a little bit more about what the strategy for the Libertarian Party is coming forward. And I hope and I think that he was mostly talking about, obviously I do host a podcast every night, every weeknight, talking about libertarian ideas and giving a libertarian take on some of the things that are going on, particularly in the economy, both here at home and sometimes globally. They talk about other stuff too. So, but I think I do know what he's talking about. There are a number of people and sometimes I have become as well that are in the anarcho-capitalist movement that sometimes become apolitical and really don't get engaged. And I would agree that politics gives us a good platform, whether or not we're going to win elections. I have my own opinions on whether or not that even matters, but, from standpoint of a platform, he's absolutely correct. And people who have good ideas, good libertarian ideas and principles should get out there and run for office and get involved and try to do more. All right, everybody. I'm going to close off the show for tonight. Hope everybody enjoyed the debate. This is episode 22 of the Macro View. If you haven't checked out our show page, check it out. It's macroviewnews.com/podcast on Facebook. Facebook.com/TheMacroView and on Twitter, it's @TheMacroView. Share us with your friends and family and help me spread the logic of liberty. Thank you, everybody, and have a wonderful evening.
When it comes to choosing a supermarket, why not stick to the facts? Fact is, Albertsons is just better. Nicer, fresher, faster, and friendlier. Come on in and see for yourself. For a delicious dinner this week, stop by the meat department and get fresh 80% lean ground beef, ground fresh in-store daily, just $2.99 a pound when you buy 3 pounds or more. And stop by produce and pick up sweet jumbo cantaloupe, 2 for $3. Fresher meats, sweeter produce, better deals. Albertsons. Fact is, it's just better.
You have been listening to The Macro View. Tune in tomorrow night and every weeknight at 9:30 p.m. Pacific Time to help spread the logic of liberty.